So we're in Genesis chapter 34 this morning. We've got a big passage this morning. We're going to be covering chapter 34, verse 1, all the way through to verse 8 of chapter 35. I've shared this before. Most of you probably know my testimony to some degree, that I got saved when I was a freshman in college. And it happened to have been somebody who was involved with Campus Crusade for Christ, which today is called CRU, C-R-U, but it was called Campus Crusade for Christ, and it was an individual on my floor who was involved with Campus Crusade, and he had made it his goal to share the gospel with everybody on the floor, which is 64 different men, and so I was one of his targets, and I finally came to Christ near the end of my freshman year, and ended up, when I came back from my sophomore year, I got heavily involved with Campus Crusade. And ultimately, I grew like a weed, and I got to the point where I think by the time I was a junior, I was involved pretty heavily with the worship team, and I was doing some teaching, and then I became a leader in Crusade. And my last 2 years, I did the MC. I ran some of the large meetings, and we'd have 200, 300, 400 kids sometimes that would show up. This is a pretty big thing. And I remember that my last year, I was somewhere probably the beginning of the school year, that a guy by the name of Dan Knutson, who happened to be one of the on-staff members at Eau Claire for Campus Crusade for Christ, he pulled me aside, and I still remember this. He asked to meet me, so we met in one of the rooms downstairs in the dormitory, and the only way to describe it is he was there to confront me. And I don't remember all the details, but I do remember him approaching me on my behavior, my attitude, and some other things. He saw some things in me that he personally wasn't very happy with. Now, it wasn't anything dire, it wasn't anything drastic. It was just he was concerned for where I was at spiritually. And I do know that I was copying an attitude. So when he confronted me, I remember kind of, you know, sitting with my arms folded and not appreciating the fact that he was confronting me over some of my either behavior or attitudes. And again, nothing glaring, there was no drastic sin, but there was just something that wasn't right. And as a leader in Crusade, he was especially concerned. And again, I don't remember all the details, but I do remember kind of copying this attitude and thinking, well, who are you, you know? And I didn't just really wasn't willing to listen all that much to what he had to say and don't know what the big deal was, you know? And I just remember that, you know, he was gracious and he was kind, but apparently I had kind of lost my way a little bit. The fire that I had in me that he had seen for the first few years was gone. Certain behaviors and attitudes or things that he just didn't think were very Christ-like. Didn't threaten me with, well, we're just going to remove you out of leadership or anything like that at all, but you could tell he was quite concerned. And what's interesting about that is I kind of went away proud and angry and some other things, how dare he confront me kind of a thing. But after thinking about it for a few weeks, I realized that he was right. And I kind of gave myself an attitude adjustment, you know. Went back to him and I said, man, you're right. I appreciate you calling me out, you know. And I thought about that this morning because the passage we're going to look at this morning is a passage where we saw how Jacob was on his way home. God had called him to go from Padan Aram to go back home. And he stops in a place called Shechem. And he ends up staying there for about 10 years. And ultimately, as we look at our passage this morning, what we're going to see is that the Lord had called him to return home, but he stopped partway through. And I'm going to say he got sidetracked. He stopped short of completing the goal that God had given to him. And as part of that, there were some significant consequences for that decision. And we're going to see five of those today. There were consequences for him stopping in Shechem and not completing the journey to which God had called him to. And then lastly, we're going to see how God, being God, had to intervene once again in Jacob's life and kind of give him a kick in the pants to go and finish the journey and get back home where he was supposed to be, much like Dan Knutson had to pull me aside and kind of kick me in my pants as well. So we're going to see that today. So I'm going to lay some groundwork before we get into our passage, but my first point is this, that the Lord called Jacob to return home, but he stopped short of the goal, and he became complacent living in a Canaanite city named Shechem. So again, the Lord had called him home, go back to your parents, But he stopped short of that goal and just kind of got stuck for about 10 years. Got a little bit complacent. Got real comfortable living where he was at. So God's plan was to return Jacob not just to the land of Canaan, but actually said he was going to send him all the way back home to his family. And that's important. We see that he left home in Genesis chapter 28. And the home at that time was Beersheba. And when he meets the Lord at Bethel, God actually tells him, I'm going to return you back to your father's house. In fact, Jacob recognized that because Jacob even says in chapter 28, verse 21, I will return to my father's house in safety. So he knew that God's promise was not just to return him back to the land of Canaan, which was very large, but specifically back to his father's house. We see that again in chapter 31. After 20 years of living in Padan Aram or Mesopotamia, God called Jacob to go back to his family. Turn to Genesis chapter 31, if you will. Genesis chapter 31. Just real quickly at verse 3, it says, Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So again, the call was not just to go back to Canaan, but to go back to your relatives, go back to your family. Jump down to verses 16 through 18. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our fathers belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. That's his wives. And then it says in verse 17, then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all the livestock and all the property which he had gathered. He had acquired livestock which he had gathered in Padan Aram. And look at this, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. So Jacob set out to do what the Lord had told him to do, which was not just to go back to the land of Canaan, but specifically back to his parents, back to his family. Genesis chapter 32, look at verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. So you'll notice there it specifically says again, his relatives. So God's call wasn't just to go back to the land of Canaan anywhere he chose. It was specifically to go back to his relatives, back to his family, back to Isaac, his father. Now, if you remember back in chapter 33 last week, Jacob finally had crossed over the river into the land of Canaan. So he is just on that cusp getting into the land of Canaan, which is a good thing because that's the beginning of God's fulfillment of his promises to him. But he first stopped at a place called Succoth. We believe that he stopped there because of what he said last week, which is that the children are tired. They had traveled some 400 plus miles. They had another 100 miles to go or so. So it makes sense that he pulled off at Succoth for a little bit to get some rest, to care for the flock so that he wouldn't run the flocks into the ground. But then after he left Succoth, he heads to a place called Shechem. And he stops there again. The general consensus is that Jacob stopped in Shechem and was there for 10 years, a full decade. This was not just some, all right, I got to get a little bit of rest and then we'll move on. He planted roots in Shechem. It was on a major trade route. It was a significant city. Estimates are sometimes as high as a couple of thousand people, but it had a wall. It was a walled city. It had a city gate. So this was a well-established city. Population estimates range upwards in maybe the thousands, maybe more. Chapter 33, verse 18 tells us that Jacob bought land just outside the city, which implies that he intended to stay and to make it his home for a while. And that's exactly what we see. Now, it's not really clear why Jacob stopped there for such a long time. What is clear, however, is that it wasn't home. It wasn't Bathsheba. It wasn't where Beersheba. It wasn't where his family was. And Isaac, his father, wasn't there. Remember, the Lord told him, go back to your father, Isaac. And so, we don't know why he stopped, but it clearly wasn't home, wasn't Beersheba, wasn't back around his relatives, certainly wasn't back before Isaac. Now, I want to be careful because the Bible never specifically states that stopping in Shechem was a sin or some direct violation or disobedience to God, but God's command was to return to his family. But that's at least 75 miles further away from Shechem. So he had stopped short of what God had commanded him to do. I'm going to suggest that while I want to be careful and not claim that this is outright disobedience or rebellion or sin, that it did fall short of God's command. And Jacob ended up becoming complacent, maybe even comfortable while living in Shechem. And we're going to see that as we go through some of the consequences. As I mentioned, there's at least five consequences for him stopping here in Shechem. And I think those are going to help us as we think through this. We're going to keep the takeaways. I've got three of them for us to the very end today. I want to just fairly quickly go through these five consequences that Jacob and his family faced because of their decision to stop in Shechem. The first consequence of living in Shechem was the violation of Jacob's daughter Dinah. Look at verses 1 through 4 of chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, saw the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Give me this young girl for a wife." So the first thing we see here is the violation of Jacob's daughter. That's the first consequence of stopping in Shechem. It's not exactly certain what is meant by Dinah going out to see the daughters of the land, but most agree that it reflects a curiosity. She wanted to go see how the other half lived, how the women of Canaan lived. Now you got to remember that these are Hivites here. These were Canaanites, and the scriptures never has anything good to say about the Canaanites in terms of their behavior, their immorality, their violence, and everything else. But it tells us here that she went out to see how they lived, or see the women in the land, and it shows a curiosity. Now, this in no way suggests that she was responsible or to blame for what happened to her. Most people believe that she was probably about 13 years old at this time, and the reason for that is Joseph was born after her, and we know that later on in the passage, he's taken off into captivity at 17. So they believe that about this time, Dinah would have been about 13 years old, that she set out to go find out about these women in the land of Canaan. So there must have been something about these Canaanite women, their culture, that sparked her curiosity and caused her to leave the comfort and the protection and the safety of her home and wander out into this city, apparently all by herself. And while she was out about the city, she caught the eye of a very prominent individual. The city is named after him, Shechem. It says that he saw her and he took her and he lay with her by force. Other translations say that he violated her, sexually assaulted her, humiliated her. Some even say that he raped her. And that's the implication here, that he took advantage of her. He was so infatuated with her that after raping her, he then tried to win her affection. Notice that it says here that he spoke tenderly to her. It's more literally, he spoke to her heart. It's a phrase that's used in Hosea, used in Judges, used in 2 Samuel, all to refer to speaking tenderly to someone like a spouse to win them back. So essentially what you have here is he violates her and then he tries to smooth things over in talking to her because he's infatuated with her. And he tries to win her affection after having violated her. Pretty disgusting and disturbing thing. And then he goes to his father and he demands, "Get me this girl now for my wife." He's going to take what he's already taken. So that's the first consequence, is the rape of his daughter. Now, can I say that it wouldn't have happened if they wouldn't have gone anywhere else? I can't make that statement, but this was a culture that was known for their sexual immorality. In fact, when Abraham had traveled in areas like this, he was concerned that they would take his wife, right? He knew that about the culture. And so the first consequence of getting comfortable in Shechem was what we see here. The second consequence of living in Shechem was what I'm going to call Jacob's reticence. Look at verses 5 through 7 of chapter 34. Look at what happened, how he responds to this. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. But his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter. For such a thing ought not to be done. Reticence refers to being inclined to remain silent, and that certainly describes Jacob here. In fact, Jacob's silence after learning of Dinah's rape is both deafening and shocking here. Verse 5 tells us that when he learned of the rape of his daughter, he kept silent. And it says he kept silent until his sons came in from the field. Well, what's interesting is you notice what happens before that? It says that before the sons came in from the field, Hamor, the father of Shechem, came to Jacob. And then it says that Jacob's son came in from the field when they had heard about this. So they hadn't heard about this from Jacob. Jacob, this whole time, has remained silent. And in fact, what's interesting about this is we're going to see in the next section, the next consequence, that this conversation that takes place between Hamor and Shechem and then Jacob and the sons, he says nothing. He doesn't speak until much later. Now, maybe he did say something there, but the text doesn't describe it. And I think there's a reason for that. Because the author is trying to emphasize that Jacob stayed silent. In fact, his sons are the ones that do something about this. And so the second consequence of living in Shechem was that Jacob responded with silence. He was reticent to do anything. What happened to Jacob while living in Shechem that so deadened his sense of justice that he refused to speak out when his daughter was raped? And maybe I'm overstating it, but think about this for a minute. Jacob did not keep silent when Laban deceived him over Leah and Rachel. He confronted him. He spoke up. He didn't keep silent when Rachel unfairly accused him of not giving her a baby. In fact, he laid into her. He didn't keep silent when Laban's sons accused him of wrongdoing with Laban's flocks, or when Laban confronted him, or when Laban tried to rip him off by changing his wages. Jacob didn't keep silent, he confronted him. He didn't keep quiet when Laban chased him down after leaving the land and stealing his idols. Jacob never seemed to have a problem confronting anybody that wronged him, but when his daughter was raped, for some reason, he stayed silent. I'm trying not to disparage him too much here, but it's clear in the text the emphasis is on the fact that he stayed silent. And I believe it's because he had become comfortable and complacent living in Shechem around the Canaanites. There may have been an element of being concerned to speak out. After all, Hamor and Shechem were probably the king and the prince. They were the leaders. Maybe he didn't want the confrontation with them. I don't know. But definitely, there was a consequence for living in Shechem that led to his silence. The third consequence of living in Shechem was Jacob's compromise on intermarriage with the Canaanites. Look at verses 8 through 12. But Hamor spoke with them, meaning Jacob and his sons, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give you whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me, but give me the girl in marriage." So the third consequence of living in Shechem is that Jacob's compromise on intermarriage with the Canaanites. All of the speaking in these verses is done by Hamor and Shechem. Again, Jacob stays silent, it appears. What they proposed, however, was not just giving Dinah to Shechem to be the wife, but what was being proposed here was intermarrying between the clans of Jacob and Hamor. Now, why is that a problem? Abraham prohibited Isaac from taking a wife from among the Canaanites. Isaac prohibited Jacob from doing the same thing. Jacob and Rebekah knew firsthand the issues created by intermarrying with the Canaanites because of what Esau had done. Remember what it says about Esau's wives and how they were bitterness to the soul of his parents? They knew the consequences. Jacob knew the consequences of marrying Canaanite women. And yet here he is, doesn't say a word, at least not one that's recorded. In fact, the only ones that are going to speak up are the sons. Jacob remains silent here. Again, it wasn't just the taking of the daughter, but the idea of intermarrying. In other words, give us your daughters, we'll give you our sons, we'll all intermarry, we'll all be happily, we'll all live happily ever after. It stands in stark contrast to what Abraham and Isaac had said to their children. Don't marry Canaanite women. Jacob's complete silence, not just in these verses, but all the way through the rest of the passage until the very end, suggests he didn't share the same convictions that Abraham and Isaac did about intermarrying with the Canaanites. It's the only conclusion we can come to here. He doesn't stand up against it. He doesn't say, no, we shouldn't do that. Instead, it appears that he's open to the idea. And we see that next. The fourth consequence of living in Shechem was the deceit of Jacob's sons. Look at verses 13 through 24. But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit, because he had defiled Dinah their sister. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us, be circumcised. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's sons. The young man did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of the city, saying, "These men are friendly to us. Therefore, let them live in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us." All who went out of the gate of the city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out to the gate of the city. So essentially, what we find here again is Jacob's sons agree to this deal, but we're going to find out in a minute that it was all a ruse. But Jacob apparently doesn't know it's a ruse. We find that a little bit later. So apparently Jacob's okay with this. As long as they get circumcised, we'll go ahead and we'll intermarry. It's not hard to see the irony here with the word deceit, though. Notice it starts right out of the gate with verse 13. Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit. What's interesting about this is every time this word deceit is used in the Bible, in the Old Testament, it's used as a reference to a negative context, a sin. And so this is described as what they proposed here is a wicked act. It's a sinful act. Jacob's sons never intended to accept Haman's and Shechem's proposal. It was all ruse. We'll get to that in a minute. In some respect, you know, I kind of want to praise Jacob's sons for their brilliant plan. Essentially what they did was they said, okay, we'll have these guys circumcise themselves. They won't be able to walk for a few days. Then we just take them all out. Brilliant plan. Okay, they trick the guys, you know. And to be real honest, there are a number of pastors and a number of commentaries that take that approach. They actually refer to what they are doing here as a righteous act. And the problem I have with that is because it comes right out of the gate and says, deceit. The Bible doesn't present this as a righteous act. Jacob's going to respond to it a little bit later as an unrighteous act. So how these pastors and commentaries can say, this is a righteous thing they did. And they partly do it because they say, Jacob refused, so the sons had to do it. But again, that's not the way it's presented. It's presented as a very deceitful thing. In fact, what's interesting about it to me is that they use a religious symbol as their weapon. Have we ever seen that in Christianity sometimes? You know? God didn't intend that circumcision be used this way. It was a sign of the covenant that he made with Abraham. It wasn't to be used as a weapon against your enemies. That's a form of blasphemy in many respects. So this fourth consequence of living in Shechem was the deceit of Jacob's sons. They do a wicked thing here. The fifth consequence, the last one we'll cover here, is the violence and the vengeance of Jacob's sons. It wasn't just the deceit. The deceit was bad enough. But the fifth and final consequence here of living in Shechem was the violence and the vengeance of Jacob's sons. Look at verses 25 through 31. Now it came about on the third day when they were in pain. Oof. And two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male in the city. They killed Hamor. They killed his son Shechem with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defied their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys, and that which was in the city, and that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all their wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men, being few in number, they will be gathered together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. But they said, should we treat our sister as a harlot? So the fifth consequence is the violence and the vengeance of Jacob's sons that we see here. The reason I refer to this as vengeance and not justice is because that's exactly what it was. This wasn't justice. It was vengeance. Justice would have been holding Shechem accountable for raping Dinah. Vengeance was incapacitating every male in the city first so that they could slaughter them, plunder the city, take the flocks, take all they owned, and then take the women and the children. That's vengeance. That's not justice. It's a little bit different than when God told them during the when they're going into the land with Joshua, when he told them to wipe out the inhabitants of the city. That's very different. That was God's specific judgment against them. But there's no God telling them to do this here. It's all driven by what had happened to their sister. And again, sometimes there's a fine line between justice and vengeance, but clearly this was vengeance and not justice because of the way they did it. Initially, Jacob's response suggests that he was only concerned how his son's actions affected him. Go back and relook at verse 30. For the first time, we see Jacob speak now. And notice, he doesn't call them out necessarily for the horrendous act and the wickedness of that act. Look at what he says. You've brought trouble on me. What? By making me odious among the inhabitants of the land. So he's concerned that their actions now are going to make it difficult for him in the land. The people of the land are going to hate him. He's going to be odious. He's going to stink among them. He says that his numbers being few, he may be attacked. He may be destroyed. And it's interesting the way that it says, where do we do this with the kids sometimes, especially, you know, like when talking with Kimberly sometimes. I. Notice that? They will gather against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. He seems more concerned about their actions creating trouble for him than the fact that what they did was vengeance and dishonored God. Now, with that said, I'm going to give Jacob some credit here, because at least later in his life he recognized that what they had did was more than just an offense against him. Turn to chapter 49, verses 5 and 7. At the end of his life, Jacob goes to bless his children, and he pronounces something about them. Sometimes it was a blessing, sometimes a curse. But Genesis chapter 49, look at verses 5 through 7. Look at what he says about these two individuals, these two sons, and their behavior. Jump down to verses 5. Let me get there real quick here. Simeon and Levi are the ones that primarily committed this act. So he's talking to his sons here, and he's again pronouncing something about each one of his sons. And so he gets to verse 5 and he says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's a curse. Notice he calls them out for their violence, their anger, calls them self-willed, refers to their actions as wrath and cruel. He prayed that their soul would not enter into his counsel, that his glory would not be united in their assembly, it says. He even cursed them, saying that their descendants would be dispersed and scattered among Israel, which is rather interesting because the tribe of Levi didn't receive their own allotment of land, did they? And not only that, but Simeon, the tribe of Simeon, was actually engulfed and incorporated into Israel later. So exactly what Jacob had prophesied here came true. The tribes were ultimately punished for these actions. So we find that a final consequence of staying in Shechem was this violence and vengeance that the sons felt perfectly fine committing. The last thing we see in this passage, after we get through all of this here, is that God once again intervenes in Jacob's life to set him back on course in accordance with his purpose and plan. Jacob had gotten sidetracked, got stuck in Shechem for a decade. We see the consequences of him being there. I think there's an unfortunate thing that takes place in the way that this chapter has been broken down, because you get these chapter headings. In fact, somebody asked me about this the other day. Like, why do we have the chapter breaks and verse breaks and stuff in the scriptures? Because that's not the way they were written originally. Well, it's a way to kind of categorize things for us, you know, to help us to be able to, you know, turn to this passage, turn to that passage. It was something that was added back about the 8th century. And what's interesting, though, sometimes is the chapter breaks aren't always great. And this is one where I believe that the first 8 verses of chapter 35 actually belong with chapter 34. It's a conclusion to what we just read. So we're going to ignore the chapter heading in verse 5. We're going to read these 8 verses here in just a minute. We began our teaching today with a reminder that God's plan and his command was for Jacob to return to his family, which was in southern Canaan. Along the way, he gets stopped. He falls short of the goal. He gets sort of sidetracked. He decides to make his home in the land of Shechem. It appears to have these severe consequences. And then look at what happens in verse 1. Then God said to Jacob, so God again speaks to him and he says, arise, go up to Bethel and live there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away your foreign gods which are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which they had, and the rings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was in Shechem, or near Shechem. And they journeyed there on a great terror upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. He built an altar there, and he called the place El Bethel, which is God, house of God, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the oak. It was named Allon Bakuth. So God calls Jacob, you notice here, back to Bethel. He's supposed to be going to Beersheba. He's supposed to be going south. He still calls him south, but he tells him, go and live in Bethel for a little while. Which is a little bit bizarre, because remember the goal was go home to your family, but for some reason God now calls him back to Bethel instead. Now Bethel is on the way. So the question is, why would God do that? Why would God only say, go to Bethel? Well, Bethel was about 25 miles south of Shechem. It was on the route to go back home. But he specifically says, go there and live. Go there and dwell for a while. God seems to be violating his own little plan here, doesn't he? Wants him to go back home, but now tells him, wait a minute. Well, the reason God sent him to Bethel was to make an altar to God, is what it says. Building an altar had one purpose. And one purpose, that one purpose was worship. And that's at the core of these eight verses here. Verse 1 begins with the command to go to Bethel and make an altar to God. Verse 3, Jacob acknowledges that he was going to Bethel to make an altar to God. Verse 7, it says when he arrived in Bethel, he built an altar to God. Remember we talk about the repetition of words? All three of these references to the altar imply that God was calling Jacob to go back to Bethel to worship him. That, I think, is significant. Why Bethel? What was so important about Bethel? Well, one reason was because Bethel was where God first met Jacob. That's where he first appeared to him. In fact, he even tells us that right here in chapter 1. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and live there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. Verse 2, so Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, put away your foreign gods which are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel and I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress. Bethel was important to Jacob because that's where God had first appeared to him and first made the promises to him. The second reason was that Jacob's household was involved with idolatry. Look at this. It says here that he tells them to put away their foreign gods, take off their jewelry that they were wearing. They had been involved with idolatry, likely in part because they were living in an idolatrous place, living among the Canaanites. Now, that's probably not the only reason. We know that when they left Mesopotamia, they took some of Laban's gods, but as we had mentioned, it was likely the teraphim were probably used to worship Yahweh. This is something probably different here. Jacob recognizes that they were idol worshippers, and he tells them, put away all those idols. We have to go back. We're going to worship God. Put away the idols. We'll return where God first appeared to me. A third reason, and we won't see this until next week, was that God is going to appear to him again at Bethel. I also have to remember that Bethel was important because that's where Abraham had worshipped God as well. That's an important place. It's called the house of God for a reason. And so I believe that what God does here is he basically kicks Jacob in the pants and says, I'm going to take you back to Bethel. We've got to get some things straight here. You're stuck in Shechem. Look at what staying in Shechem is doing. You need to continue home, but we need you to stop in Bethel first. You need to be reminded of the promises. You need to be reminded of who owns you in some respects. Whose God is your God? You need to be reminded of the vow, because Jacob also made his vow to God at Bethel. He needed to be reminded of all of that. And primarily through worship. It's a reset for Jacob before he finally goes back home. So what do we do with all of this? Three takeaways I'm going to focus on here. The first takeaway is that it's easy for us to become comfortable living in and among the world when we forget God's purpose and plan and call in our lives, isn't it? I think Jacob forgot that. He starts off on the journey okay. All right, Lord, we're going to head back home. But he stops, gets stuck for a year, for a decade. And look at the consequences. That's like us sometimes. When we stop seeking or pursuing God, when we stop short of the goal that he has for us, we can become comfortable, even satisfied, living in this world. Do you think that maybe the American church today has a problem with that? American Christianity looks very different from Christianity in parts of the world where they don't have the luxuries and the freedoms and everything else that we do here. And they've got to worship God in persecution and difficulties and hardship and hatred and everything else. Is it any wonder that maybe, or why maybe, the church here in America looks an awful lot like the world? I was listening to an individual the other day. He's a podcaster, supposedly born-again Christian, and he's, you know, trying to challenge culture. Every other word, I swear, out of his mouth in his video or in his podcast was the F word. And I'm thinking, you know what? Why do you have to talk like that? Why does that not concern you, talking like that? It's a filthy potty mouth. But yet, it just flows like honey off your lips. I've been looking at recently the some of the things related to like marriage and dating and other things within the Christian church. And it's shocking how many Christians today are living together outside of marriage and attending evangelical churches, and there's no problem with that. How can we feel comfortable doing that? Because we've become like the world. It's what the world does. It's how the world behaves. We've lost sight of God's call and purpose on our lives. I think that's what happened to Jacob. He plants he buys his land in Shechem. He gets a little sidetracked, and he becomes a lot like the culture, if you will. Became comfortable with that. Loses sight of the fact that, no, you're supposed to be going back home to fulfill the promises God has called you to. And so God has to intervene and say, Jacob, wake up. I need to take you back for some worship. I need to remind you before you head home. Dan did that for me. For some reason, Dan saw that I'd become much too comfortable just kind of falling into my old patterns or something. And he realized I need to be shaken up. Second takeaway, I think, for us is that sometimes there are significant consequences for when we become comfortable and satisfied living in and among this world. We are supposed to be in the world, but not of the world. And I don't think we really realize that when we become complacent, we become more interested in earthly treasures and other things than we do the spiritual and heavenly ones. That when we begin to look and act like the world instead of standing out like beacons of light in the world, there are consequences. Individually, there are consequences. There are consequences in our family. If we think about what's happening with Christian youth in this country today, shocking. Why? Because as parents, we haven't lived like we should live. The church hasn't done what the church is supposed to do. And youth are now facing the consequence of that. They're being more raised by their peers and by culture and by social media than they are by parents who feed them the word and teach and instruct them. Sound like I'm being harsh? That's the reality. I'm not the one saying it. That's just what we see. Many youth groups and many churches are basically video games and fun. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be video games and fun. There should be. But when that's all it is, when that's the emphasis, think about so much of the Christian worship music that we have nowadays that is so focused on me, 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 my, and it's all just very fluff. And I got to talking with Matt and Dustin a couple weeks ago about, I've often wondered if I could get my hands on music that has been written by maybe Christians in North Korea that have to go out into the middle of the lake in boats and pairs of two and threes just so they can worship. If they wrote a song, what would it be compared to what I'm hearing on 104.9 The River. And again, I love a lot of that stuff. I'm not mocking Christian music. I'm just saying that very different themes would probably surface to the top. Because when we're like the world, we talk like the world, we act like the world. That's a consequence. And so when we become complacent and comfortable with the world around us, there are consequences. I don't think we always recognize those. The third takeaway is that sometimes God has to intervene. Sometimes he has to wake us up. Sometimes he's got to call us back to Bethel, so to speak. Call us back to worship him, to get rid of the idols in our lives, to remind us of his promises and our commitment that we made to him. Sometimes that comes through an individual that calls us out. Somebody like a Dan who pulls me aside and says, hey, or a professor in seminary that pulled me aside that didn't like the way that I had been critiquing those I disagreed with in my papers and said, hey, this isn't Christ-like. You're acting like the world when you do this. You need to act like Christ instead. Sometimes God has to do that to us, doesn't he? Sometimes it's through trials and difficulties. The Bible does tell us that God will chastise us because he loves us, right? So sometimes God has to intervene, and that kick in the pants is more like a spanking. But he does it because he loves us. He wants to call us back to genuine worship of him and to remind us of the commitment and the vow that we've made to him. I think there's some great lessons in this for us as we look at that. It's clear, at least to me in this text, that while Jacob may not have been deliberately setting out to sin or to violate or to not follow God's plan, he got sidetracked. Maybe he just stopped in Shechem because they needed a rest, but he kind of got stuck there for a decade. And his family paid the consequences. And God finally had to intervene and say, no, come on, we need to get you moving again. But instead of just saying, go home and do it, go back to it. Instead, he says, let's go back to Bethel, where I can remind you of the promises I made to you and the vow you made to me and engage you in worship. That's a pretty amazing thing, isn't it?